The insolence of the look was so great that for a moment Jake contemplated gunplay. He wanted to shoot the look off the black man's face, but instead he touched his horse lightly with the spurs and followed the Suggs brothers across the plain. He felt angry. The barber and the whore he had been looking forward to had been put off. Soon he heard the black man's horse fall in behind him. Dan Suggs traveled at a leisurely pace. They didn't see Will Barger or his horses again that day. When they spotted a spring with a few low trees growing by it, Dan even stopped for a nap. "You don't want to steal horses in the daytime," he remarked when he awoke. "It works better at night. That way you can put it off on Indians, if you're lucky." "We better pull the shoes off these horses," Roy Suggs said. "Indians don't use horseshoes much." "You're a stickler for details, ain't you?" Dan said. "Who's going to track us?" He lay back in the shade and put his hat over his eyes. "Will Barger might, if he's so rough," little Eddie said. Dan Suggs just chuckled. "Hell, I thought we'd come up here to rob banks and regulate settlers," Jake said. "I don't remember hiring on to steal horses. Stealing horses is a hanging crime, as I recall." "I never seen such a bunch of young ladies," Dan said. "Everything's a hanging crime up here in Kansas. They ain't got around to making too many laws." "That may be," Jake said. "Horse stealing don't happen to be my line of work." "You're young. You can learn a new line of work," Dan said, rising up on an elbow. "And if you'd rather not learn, we can leave you here dead on the ground. I won't tolerate a shirker." With that, he put his hat back over his face and went to sleep. Jake knew he was trapped. He could not fight four men. The Suggs brothers all took naps, but Frog Lips sat by the spring all afternoon, cleaning his guns. Late in the afternoon, Dan Suggs got up and took a piss by the spring. Then he lay down on his belly and had a long drink of water. When he got up, he mounted his horse and rode off without a word to anyone. His brothers quickly mounted and followed him, and Jake had no choice but to do the same. Frog Lip, as usual, brought up the rear. "Dan's feeling real bloody," little Eddie said. "Well, he gets that way," Roy said. "I hope you don't expect me to preach him a sermon." "He don't want them horses," little Eddie said. "He wants to kill that man." "I doubt he'll turn down free horses once he has them," Roy said. Jake felt bitter that the day had turned so bad. It was his bad luck again. He couldn't seem to beat it. If Will Barger had been traveling even a half a mile further west, they would have never seen him and his horses, and they would be in Dodge, enjoying the comforts of the town. On that vast plain, spotting three men and some horses were a mere accident, as much a matter of luck as the bullet that killed Benny Johnson. Yet both had happened. It was enough to make a man a pessimist. Such things had started occurring regularly. They soon struck Will Barger's trail and followed it west through the sunset and the long dusk. The trail led northwest toward the Arkansas, easy to follow even in the twilight. Dan Suggs never slowed. They struck the river and swam it by moonlight. Jake hated to ride sopping wet, but was offered no choice, for Dan Suggs didn't pause. Nobody said a word when they came to the river. Nobody said one afterward. The moon was well over in the west before Dan Suggs drew rein. "Go find him, Frog," he said. "I doubt they're far." "Do I shoot or not?" the black man asked. "Hell no, don't shoot," Dan said. "Do you think I'd ride all this way and swim a river just to miss the fun? Come on back when you find him." Frog Lip was back in a few minutes. "We nearly rode into them," he said. "They're close." Dan Suggs had been smoking, but he quickly put his smoke out and dismounted. "You hold the horses," he said to little Eddie. "Come on, once you hear the shooting." "I can shoot as good as Roy," little Eddie protested. "Hell, Roy couldn't hit his foot if it were nailed to a tree," Dan said. "Anyway, we're going to let Jake shoot them. He's the man with a reputation." He took his rifle and walked off. Jake and the others followed. There was no sign of a campfire, No sign of anything but plains and darkness. Though Frog Lip had said the men were close, it seemed to Jake that they walked a long time. He didn't see the horses until he almost bumped into one. For a moment, he thought of trying to grab a horse and run away bareback. The commotion would warn Wilbarger, and maybe one or two of the Suggs boys would get shot. But the horse quickly stepped away from him, and the moment passed. He drew his pistol, not knowing what else to do. They had found the horses, but he didn't know where the camp was. Frog Lip was near him, watching, Jake supposed. When the first shot came, he didn't know who fired it. Though he saw a flash from a rifle barrel, it seemed so far away that he almost felt it must be another battle. Then gunfire flared just in front of him. Too much to be produced by three men, it seemed. So much shooting panicked him for a second, and he fired twice into the darkness, with no idea of what he might be shooting at. He heard gunfire behind him. It was Frog Lip shooting. He began to sense running figures, although it was not clear to him who they were. Then there were five or six shots close together, like sudden thunder, and the sound of a running horse. Jake could see almost nothing. Once in a while he would think he saw a man, but he couldn't be sure. "Frog, did you get him?" he heard Dan Suggs ask. "No, he got me, damn him," he heard the black man say. "I swear I put three into him, but he made it to that horse anyway," Dan said. "You alive, Roy?" "I'm alive," Roy Suggs said, from back near the horse herd. "Well, what are you doing over there?" Dan wanted to know. "The damn fight was over here." "We want the horses, don't we?" Roy asked, anger in his voice. "I want that goddamn Wilbarger worse," Dan said. "What about you, Spoon?" "Not hurt," Jake said. "Hell, you and Roy might as well have stayed in Dodge for all the good you are in the dark," Dan said. Jake didn't answer. He was just glad he had not been forced to shoot anybody. It seemed ridiculous attacking men in the dark. Even Indians waited until sunup. He took some hope from the fact that Frog Lip claimed to have been hit, though how anybody knew where to shoot was a mystery to him. "Where's that goddamn kid?" Dan asked. "I told him to bring the horses. Old Wilbarger's getting away." "Where'd you get it, Frog?" Frog Lip didn't answer. "Goddamn old son of a bitch," Dan said. "I guess he's killed Frog. Go get Eddie, Roy." "You told him to come. I guess he'll come," Roy said. "You best go get him unless you think you're bulletproof," Dan said in a deadly voice. "I ain't going if Wilbarger's out there," Roy said. "You won't shoot me neither. I'm your brother." There were two more shots, so close that Jake jumped. "Did I get you?" Dan asked. "No, and don't shoot no more," Roy said in a surprised voice. "Why would you shoot at me? There ain't nobody else around to shoot at except Jake. And you know his reputation," Dan said sarcastically. They heard horses coming. "Boys," little Eddie called out. "No, mostly girls here tonight," Dan said. "Are you waiting for election day or what? Bring the goddamn horses." Little Eddie brought them. The dawn was behind him, very faint but coming. Soon it was possible to make out the results of the battle. Wilbarger's two men were dead, still in their blankets. One was Chick, the little weasel Jake remembered seeing the morning they brought the horses in from Mexico. He had been hit in the neck by a rifle bullet. "Frog Lips," Dan said. The bullet had practically torn his head loose from his body. The corpse reminded Jake of a dead rabbit, perhaps because Chick had rabbit-like teeth, exposed now in a stiff grimace. The other dead man was just a boy, probably Wilbarger's wrangler. Of Wilbarger himself, there was no sign. "I know I put three into him," Dan Suggs said. "He must have slept with the damn reins in his hand, or he'd have never got to his horse." Frog Lip lay on the ground, still gripping his rifle. His eyes were wide open, and he was breathing as heavily as a horse after a long run. His wound was in the groin. His pants were wet with blood. The rising sun shone in his face, which was bearded with sweat. "Who shot Frog?" Little Eddie asked in surprise. "Why, that damn Wilbarger. Who else?" Dan said. He had no more than glanced at Froglip. He was scanning the plains with his spyglasses, hoping to catch a glimpse of the cowman, but the plains were empty. "I never thought anybody would get Frog," Little Eddie said, unnerved by what he saw. Dan Suggs was snarling with frustration. He glared at his brothers as if they were solely responsible for Wilbarger's escape. "You boys ought to go home and teach school," he said. "It's all you're good for." "What did you expect me to do?" Roy asked. "I can't see in the dark." Dan walked over and looked down at Froglip. He ignored his brothers. He knelt down and pulled the Negro's blood-stained shirt loose from his pants, exposing the wound. After a second, he stood up. "Frog, I guess this was your unlucky day," he said. "I guess we better just shoot you." Froglip didn't answer. He didn't move or even blink his eyes. "Shoot him and let's go," Dan said, looking at Little Eddie. "Shoot Frog?" Little Eddie said, as if he had not heard quite right. "Yes, Frog's the one with the slug in his gut," Dan said. "He's the one that needs to finish up dying. Shoot him and let's ride." "I hate to shoot Frog," Little Eddie said in a dazed tone. "I guess we'll just leave him for the buzzards then, if you're so squeamish," Dan said. He removed the rifle from the Negro's hand and took the big pistol out of his belt. "Ain't you gonna let him keep his guns?" Roy asked. "Nope," Dan said. "He won't need 'em, but we might." With that, he mounted and rode over to look at the horse herd they had captured. "You shoot him, Roy," Little Eddie said. "I hate to." "No, Dan's mad at me anyway," Roy said. "If I do something he ordered you to do, I'll be the one shot." With that, he mounted and rode off too. Jake walked over to his horse, feeling that it had been a black day when he met the Suggses. "Would you like to shoot him, Jake?" Little Eddie asked. "I've known him all my life." "I wouldn't care to," Jake said. He remembered how insolent Froglip had been only the day before, and how he had wanted to shoot him then. It had been a rapid turnabout. The man lay on the ground, dying of a cruel wound, and none of the men he rode with even wanted to put him out of his misery. "Well, damn," Little Eddie said. "Nobody's much help." He shrugged, drew his gun, and without another word walked over and shot Froglip in the head. The body jerked, and that was that. "Get his money," Dan Suggs yelled. "I forgot to." Little Eddie went through the dead man's bloody pockets before he mounted. Jake had supposed they might try to go after Wilbarger, since he was wounded, but Dan Suggs turned the horse herd north. "Ain't we going after that man?" Roy asked. "I couldn't track an elephant, and neither could you," Dan said. "Frog was our tracker. I shot Wilbarger 3 times. I expect he'll die." "I thought we was going to Abilene," Little Eddie said. "Abilene ain't this way." Dan sneered at his brother. "I wish Wilbarger had shot you instead of Frog," he said. "Frog was a damn sight better hand." Jake thought maybe he had seen the last of the killing. He felt it could be worse. The shooting had all been in pitch darkness. Wilbarger hadn't seen him. He couldn't be connected with the raid. It was luck of a sort. If he could just get free of the Suggses, he wouldn't be in such hopeless trouble. As he rode along, trailing the 25 horses, he decided the best thing for him would be to leave the West. He could travel over to St. Louis and catch a boat down to New Orleans, or even go east to New York. Both of them were fine towns for gamblers, so he had heard. In either one, he could be safe and could pursue the kind of life he enjoyed. Looking back on it, it seemed to him that he had been remarkably lucky to survive as long as he had in such a rough place, where killing was an everyday affair. No man's luck lasted forever, and the very fact that he had fallen in with the Suggses suggested that his was about exhausted. He resolved to bend his wits to getting out while the getting was possible. The death of Froglip made the task easier, for as Dan said, Froglip was the only tracker in the crowd. If he could just manage to get a good jump somehow, he might get away. And if he did, he wouldn't stop until he hit the Mississippi. With his mind made up, he felt cheerful. It always gave a man a lift to escape death. It was a beautiful sunny day, and he was alive to see it. With any luck at all, he had seen the end of the trouble. His good mood lasted 2 hours, and then something occurred which turned it sour. It seemed as if the world was deserted except for them and the horses. And then, to his surprise, he saw a tent. It was staked under a single tree directly ahead of them. Near the tent, two men were plowing with four mules. Dan Suggs was riding ahead of the horse herd, and Jake saw him lope off toward the settlers. He didn't think much about it. He was watching the tent to see if any women were around. Then he heard the faint pop of a shot and looked up to see one of the settlers fall. The other man was standing there, no gun in his hand, nothing. He stood as if paralyzed, and in a second Dan Suggs shot him too. Then he trotted over to the tent, got off his horse, and went inside. Jake hardly knew what to think. He had just seen two men shot in the space of seconds. He had no idea why. By the time he got near the tent, Dan Suggs had drug a little trunk outside and was rifling it. He pitched the clothes which were in the trunk out on the grass. His brothers rode over to join the fun and were soon holding up various garments to see if they fit. Jake rode over too, feeling nervous. Dan Suggs was clearly in a killing mood. Both farmers lay dead on the grass near their mule team, which was quietly grazing. Both had bullet holes in their foreheads. Dan had shot them at point-blank range. "Well, I didn't have much but a watch," Dan said, holding up a fine-looking silver pocket watch. "I guess I'll take the watch." His brothers found nothing of comparable value, although they searched the tent thoroughly. While they were looking, Dan started a fire with some coal oil he had found and made some coffee. "I'll tell you. Let's hang him," he said, strolling over to look at the dead men. Both were in their 40s. Both had scraggly beards. Roy Suggs looked puzzled. "Why would you want to hang him?" he asked. "They're already dead." "I know, but it's a shame to waste that tree," Dan said. "It's the only tree around. What's a tree good for if not to hang somebody from?" The thought made little Eddie giggle, a nervous giggle. "Dan, you beat all," he said. "I never heard of hanging dead men." Nonetheless, Dan meant it. He put ropes around both the dead men's necks and had his brothers drag them to the tree and hoist them up. It was not a large tree, and the dead men's feet were only a few inches off the ground. Jake was not called on to help, and he didn't. When the men were hung, twisting at the end of the ropes, Dan Suggs stood back to study the effect, and evidently didn't like it. His brothers were watching him nervously. It was plain from his face that he was still in an angry mood. "These goddamn sodbusters," he said. "I hate their guts and livers." "Well, that's fine, Dan," Roy said. "They're dead enough." "No, they ain't," Dan said. "A goddamn sodbuster can never be dead enough to suit me." With that, he went over and got the can of coal oil he had used to start the fire. He began to splash it on the hanged men's clothes. "What's that for?" little Eddie asked. "You've already shot 'em and hung 'em." "Yeah, and now I intend to burn 'em," Dan said. "Any objections from you school teachers?" He looked at all three of them, challenge in his angry eyes. No one said a word. Jake felt sickened by what was happening, but he didn't try and stop it. Dan Suggs was crazy. There was no doubt of that, but his craziness didn't affect his aim. The only way to stop him would be to kill him, a risky business in broad daylight. Little Eddie giggled his nervous giggle again as he watched his brother set the dead men's clothes on fire. Even with the coal oil, it wasn't easy. Van had to splash them several times before he got their clothes wet enough to blaze. But finally he did, and the clothes flared up. It was a terrible sight. Jake thought he wouldn't look, but despite himself he did. The men's sweaty clothes were burned right off them, and their scraggly beards seared. A few rags of clothes fell off beneath their feet. The men's pants burned off, leaving their belts and a few shreds of cloth around their waists. "Dan, you beat all," Little Eddie repeated several times. He giggled often. He was unnerved. Roy Suggs methodically tore the tent apart and poked through all the men's meager belongings, hoping to find valuables. "They didn't have nothing," he said. "I don't know why you even bothered to kill them." "It was their unlucky day. Same as it was Frog's," Dan said. "We'll miss Frog. The man could shoot. I wish I had that damn Wolbarger here. I'd cook him good." After drinking some more coffee, Dan Suggs mounted up. The two farmers, the trunks of their bodies blackened, still hung from the tree. "Don't you intend to bury him?" Jake asked. "Somebody's gonna find him, you know. Could be the law." Dan Suggs just laughed. "I'd like to see the law that could take me," he said. "No man in Kansas could manage it. And anyway, I fancy seeing Nebraska." He turned to his brothers, who were dispiritedly raking through the settlers' clothes, still hoping to find something worth taking. "Get them mules, boys," Dan said. "No sense in leaving good mules." With that, he rode off. "He's bloody today," Roy said, going over to the mules. "If we run into any more sodbusters, it's too bad for them." Jake's happy mood was gone. Though the day was as sunny as ever, it was clear to him that his only hope was to escape the Suggses as soon as possible. Dan Suggs could wake up feeling bloody any day, and the next time there might be no sodbusters around to absorb his fury, in which case things could turn really grim. He trotted along all day, well back from the horse herd, trying to forget the two blackened bodies, whose shoes had still been smoldering when they left.
Chapter 72.
Dietz found Wilbarger by backtracking his horse. The horse, with dried blood on the saddle and crusted in its mane, was waiting for them on the north bank of the Arkansas. Several times, as they were bringing the cattle to the crossing, the horse started to swim over to them, but turned back. Dietz crossed first, ahead of Old Dog, and recognized the horse even before he hit the bank. It was the big bay Wolbarger had ridden into Lonesome Dove several months before. He rode up and caught the horse easily, but then what looked to be a simple cattle crossing turned out to be anything but simple. Dish Boget's horse, which had crossed many rivers calmly and easily, took fright in midstream and very nearly drowned Dish. The horse went crazy in the water, and if Dish hadn't been a strong swimmer, would have pawed him under. Even then, it might have happened if Dietz had not dashed back into the water and fought the horse off long enough for Dish to get ashore. The trouble opened a gap in the line of cowboys, and some 300 cattle veered off and began to swim straight downstream. The line of cattle broke, and in no time there were pockets of cattle here and there, swimming down the Arkansas, paying no attention to the riders who tried to turn them. Newt got caught beside such a bunch, and after swimming 200 yards downstream with them, ended up on the same bank he had started out on. Eventually, the herd split into five or six groups. Augustus came over to help, but there was not much he could do. Most of the cattle went back to the south bank, but quite a few swam far downstream.
"Looks like your herd's floating away, Woodrow," Augustus said.
"I know. I'm surprised that it ain't hailing or shooting lightning bolts at us," Call said. Though the scattering was annoying, he was not seriously disturbed, for the river was fairly shallow and the banks rather low where they were crossing. It would only take a little more time to restart the cattle that had gone back to the south bank. Fortunately, no cattle were bogged, and this time no cowboys drowned.
"Good Lord," Augustus said,
as Dietz came up leading the bay.
"Where's Mr. Wilbarger, that he could afford to let his horse run loose?"
Dead, I fear, Carl said. Look at the blood on that horse's mane.
Hell, I liked Will Barger. I'd be right sorry if he's dead. I'll go have a look.
Who'll watch the girl while you're gone? Carl asked. Augustus stopped.
You're right. Might make her uneasy if I just ride off. Maybe Dietz better go have the look.
Could be Indians, you know, Carl said. I think you better move her a little closer to the wagon. Dietz didn't come back until mid-afternoon, by which time the herd was a few miles north of the Arkansas.
I doubt cattle is ever at this grass, Augustus said. I doubt anyone's trailed cattle this far west to Dodge. Buffalo's probably all that's at it.
Call's mind was on Will Barger, a resourceful man if ever he had seen one. If such a man had got caught, then there could well be serious trouble waiting for them. You're supposed to be able to smell Indians, he said to Augustus. Do you smell any?
No, I just smell a lot of cow shit. I expect my smeller will be ruined forever before this trip is over by smelling so much cow shit. Yet don't mention buffalo in the Bible, Augustus remarked.
Well, why should it, Carl said.
It might be that a buffalo is a kind of ox, only browner. Ox are mentioned in the Bible.
What got you on the Bible, Carl asked.
Boredom. Religious controversy is better than none.
If there's mad Indians around, you may get more controversy than you bargained for, Carl said. Lorena heard the remark. She was riding behind them. Mention of Indians brought back memories and made her nervous. Finally, they saw Dietz coming along the river from the southeast. It was clear from the dried sweat on his horse that he had ridden hard.
They didn't get Dietz, whoever they are, Augustus said.
I found a man, Dietz said, drawing rein. He shot. Dead? Carl asked. Dying, I spec, Dietz said. I couldn't move him. He's hit 3 times. How far away?
About 10 miles, Dietz said. I got him propped up, but I couldn't bring him.
Did he say much?
He wants to see you, if you're not too busy, Dietz said. He said if you were busy, don't make the trip.
Why would I be that busy? Augustus asked.
Dietz looked at him.
He's real polite, that gentleman, he said. I guess he thinks he might be dead before you get there.
Oh, I see. The man don't want to put nobody out. I'll go anyway. I admire his conversation.
Change horses, Carl said to Dietz, and Dietz loped off. He was trying to decide who they ought to take, and finally decided just to take P.I., Dietz, and the boy. The boy could watch the horses if there was trouble. It meant leaving the herd, but there was no help for it. There was good grazing, and the herd looked peaceful. Dish and the rest of the crew ought to be able to handle it.
Was it Indians got him? He asked when Dietz returned.
Dietz shook his head.
White men, he said. Horse thieves.
Oh, Carl said. Murder and horse thieves at that. But it relieved his mind, for horse thieves wouldn't attack an outfit as large as theirs. Augustus dropped back to explain matters to Lorena. She looked at him with worry in her eyes.
Now, Laura, you relax, he said. It wasn't Indians, after all.
What was it, then? She asked.
The man who loaned us this tent got shot. He's in a bad way, it appears. We're going to see if we can help him.
How long will it take? Lorena asked. It was already late afternoon. It meant a night without Gus, and she had not had to face one since he rescued her.
I don't know, honey. A few days, maybe. If we go after the horse thieves that shot him. If there's a chance to get him, we'll try. Carl won't let a horse thief off, and he's right.
I'll go, Lorena said. I can keep up. We don't need the tent.
No, Augustus said. You stay with the wagon. You'll be perfectly safe. I'll ask Dish to look after you.
Lorena began to shake. Maybe Gus was doing it because he was tired of her. Maybe he would never come back. He might slip off and find the woman in Nebraska. To her surprise, Gus read her mind. He smiled his devilish smile at her.
I ain't running for the bushes, if that's what you think, he said.
There ain't no bushes, she pointed out. I just don't want you to go, Gus.
I got to. A man's dying and he's asked for me. We're kind of friends. And think what would have happened when the grasshoppers hit if we hadn't had his tent to hide in. I'll be back. And I'll see that Dish looks after you in the meantime.
Why him? She asked. I don't need him. Just tell him to leave me be.
Dish is the best hand, Augusta said. Just because he's in love with you don't mean he couldn't be helpful if the storm blew up or something. It ain't his fault that he's in love with you. He's smitten, and that's all there is to it.
I don't care about him, Lorena said. I want you to come back.
I will, honey,
he said, checking the loads in his rifle. Dish could hardly believe his luck when Augustus told him to take Lorena her meals and look after her. The thought that he would be allowed to go over to the tent made him a little dizzy. You think she'll speak to me? He asked, looking at the tent. Lorena had gone inside and pulled the flaps, though it was hot.
Not today. Today she's feeling sulky. If I was you, I'd sing to her.
Sing to Lori? Dish said, incredulous.
Well, I'd be so scared I'd choke. Well, if you require timid women, there's not much I can do for you. Just keep a good guard at night and see she don't get kidnapped.
Call hated to leave the herd, and most of the cowboys hated it that he was leaving. Though it was midsummer, the skies clear, and the plains seemingly peaceful, most of the hands looked worried as the little group prepared to leave. They sat around worrying, all but Pocampo, who was singing quietly in his raspy voice as he made supper. Even Lippy was unnerved. He was modest in some matters, and had just returned from walking a mile in order to relieve his bowels in private.
"If you see any bushes, bring one back with you," he said to the mounted men.
"If we had a bush or two, I wouldn't have to walk so far just to do my business." "I don't know why you are so modest," Augustus said. "Go over and squat behind a cow. You got a hole in your stomach anyway."
"I wish we'd brought a pioneer," Lippy said.
"A little pioneer music would go good right now."
Call put Dish in charge of the outfit, meaning that he suddenly had two heavy responsibilities, Lorena and the herd. It left him subdued, just thinking about it. If anything should happen to the girl or the herd, he'd never be able to hold up his head again.
"Ease him along," Call told Dish. "Bert can scout ahead and make sure there's water."
If Dish felt subdued, Newt felt nothing but pride to have been selected for the trip. He could tell some of the other hands were envious, particularly the Rainy boys, but it was the captain's order, and no one dared to say a word. When he saw the captain put two boxes of rifle shells into a saddlebag, he felt even prouder, for it meant he might be expected to fight. The captain must have decided he was grown to bring him on such a trip. After all, only the original Hat Creek outfit, the captain and Mr. Gus, P. and Dietz, were going along, and now he was included. Every few minutes as they rode east, he put his hand on his pistol to reassure himself that it was still there. They got back to Wilbarger a little after sundown, before the plains had begun to lose the long twilight. He had reached the Arkansas before collapsing, and lay under the shade of the bank on a blanket Dietz had left him. He was too weak to do more than raise his head when they rode up. Even that exhausted him.
"Well, you just keep turning up," he said to Augustus, with a wan smile. "I've been lying here trying not to bleed on this good blanket your man left me."
Augustus stooped to examine him and saw at once there was no hope.
"I've bled so much already, I expect I'm white as snow."
Wellbarger said.
I'm a darn mess. I took one in the lung, and another seems to have ruined my hip. A third was just a flesh wound.
I don't think we can do anything about the lung, Carl said. Wellbarger smiled.
No. And neither could a Boston surgeon, he said.
He raised his head again.
Still riding that mare, I see. If I could have talked to you out of her, I probably wouldn't be lying here shot. She'd have smelt the damn horse thieves. I do think she's a beauty.
How many were there? Carl asked. Or could you get a count?
I expect it was Dan Suggs and his two brothers, and a bad nigger they ride with,
Wellbarger said.
I think I hit the nigger.
I don't know the Suggses, Carl said.
They were well known around Fort Worth for being murdering rascals,
Wellbarger said.
I never expected to be fool enough to let them murder me. It's humbling. I lived through the worst war ever fought, and then got killed by a damn sneaking horse thief. That galls me. I'll tell you. Well, any of us can oversleep. If you was to lie quiet, that lung might heal.
No, sir. Not likely, Wellbarger said.
I saw too many lung-shot boys when we were fighting the Rebs to expect that to happen. I'd rather just enjoy a little more conversation.
He turned his eyes toward the hell bitch and smiled. The sight of her seemed to cheer him more than anything.
I do admire that mare, he said. I want you to keep that mean plug of mine for your troubles. He's not brilliant, but he's sturdy.
He lay back and was quiet for a while as the dusk deepened.
I was born on the Hudson, you know, he said a little later. I fully expected to die on it. But I guess Durin, Arkansas will have to do. I wish you'd stop talking about your own death, Augusta said in a joking tone. It ain't genteel.
Wellbarger looked at him and chuckled, a chuckle that brought up blood.
Why, it's because I ain't genteel that I'm bleeding to death beside the Arkansas, he said. I could have been a lawyer, like my brother. Be in New York right now, eating oysters.
He didn't speak again until after it was full dark. Newt stood over with the horses, trying not to cry. He had scarcely known Mr. Wellbarger, and had found him blunt at first, but the fact that he was lying there on a bloody blanket, dying so calmly, affected him more than he had thought it would. The emptiness of the plains as they darkened was so immense that that affected him too, and a sadness grew in him until tears began to spill from his eyes. Captain Call and Mr. Gus sat by the dying man. Dietz was on the river bank, 100 yards away, keeping watch, and P.I. stood with Newt by the horses, thinking his own thoughts. How long will it take him to die? Newt asked, feeling he couldn't bear such a strain for a whole night.
I've seen boys linger for days, P.I. said quietly. He had always thought it impolite to talk about a man's death within his hearing. Gus's joke had shocked him a little.
But then, sometimes they just go, he added. Go when they're ready. Or even if they ain't. This man's lost so much blood, he might go over pretty soon.
Carl and Augustus knew there was nothing to do but wait, so they sat beside Wellbarger's pallet, saying little. 2 hours passed with no sound but Wellbarger's faint breathing. Then, to Carl's surprise, Wellbarger's hand reached out and clutched him for a moment.
Let's shake. For the favors you've done me, Wellbarger said weakly.
When Call had given him a handshake, Wellbarger reached for Augustus, who shook his hand in turn.
McCrae, I'll give you credit for
having written a damn amusing sign, he said. I've laughed about that sign many a time. And laughing's a pleasure. I got two good books in my saddlebags. One's Mr. Milton. The other's a Virgil. I want you to have them. The Virgil might improve your Latin.
Ben, I admit it's rusty. I'll apply myself. Many thanks.
To tell the truth, I can't read it either, Will Barker said. I could once, but I lost it. I just like to look at it on the page. Reminds me of the Hudson, my schooling and all. Now and then I catch a word. He coughed up a lot of blood, and both Call and Augustus thought it was over, but it wasn't. Will Barker was still breathing, though faintly. Call went over and told P.I. and Newt to start digging the grave. He wanted to get started after the horse thieves as soon as it was light enough to track. Restless, he walked over and helped Dietz keep watch. To Augustus's surprise, Will Barker raised his head. He had heard the digging.
Your friend's efficient, ain't he? He said. He's efficient. He likes to chase horse thieves, too. Seems like we're always having to get your horses back, Will Barker. Where do you want them delivered this time?
Oh, hell. Sell them, Will Barker said, in shaky tones. I'm done with the cow business, finally. You send the money to my brother, John Wilbarger, 50 Broadway, New York City. He coughed again. Keep the tent, he said. How's the shy young lady?
She's improved, Augustus said.
I wish we'd met sooner, McCrae. I enjoy your conversation. I hope you'll bury my man, Chick, and that boy that was with us. I wish now never hired that boy.
We'll tend to it, Augustus said.
An hour later, Will Barker was still breathing. Augustus stepped away for a minute to relieve himself, and when he came back, Will Barker had rolled off the blanket and was dead. Augustus rolled him on his back and tied him in the blanket. Call was down by the river, smoking and waiting. He looked up when Augustus approached.
He's gone.
All right, Call said.
He said he was traveling with a man and a boy, Augustus said.
Let's go then, Call said, standing up. We won't have to backtrack him. We can just look for the buzzards. Augustus was troubled by the fact that he could find nothing with which to mark Wilbarger's grave. The plains and the river bank were bare. He gave up and came to the grave just as P.I. and Dietz were covering the man with dirt.
If he had a family and they cared to look, they'd never find him.
Well, we can't help it, Call said. I know something, Dietz said. And to everyone's surprise, mounted and loped off. A few minutes later, he came loping back with the skull of a cow buffalo. I seen the bones, he said.
Man, it's better than nothing,
Augustus said as he sat the skull on the grave. Of course, it wasn't much better than nothing. A coyote would probably just come along and drag the skull off, and Wilbarger, too. Dietz had found Wilbarger's rifle, offered it to Augustus.
Give it to Newt. I got a rifle.
Newt took the gun. He had always wanted a rifle, but at the moment he couldn't feel excited. It was such a strain. People always dying. He had a headache. He wanted to cry, to be sick, or go to sleep. He didn't know which. It was such a strain that he almost wished he had been left with the wagon, although being selected to go had been his greatest pride only a few hours before. Augustus, riding beside him, noticed the boy's downcast look.
"Feeling poorly?" he asked.
Newt didn't know what to say.
He was surprised that Mr. Gus had even noticed.
"You've been on too many burying parties," Augustus said. "Old Will Barger had a sense of humor. He'd laugh right out loud if he knew he had a skull of a buffalo cow for a grave marker. Probably the only man who ever went to Yale College who was buried under a buffalo skull."
How he died hadn't been funny, Newt thought.
"It's all right, though," Augustus said. "It's mostly bones we're riding over anyway. Well, think of all the buffalo that have died on these plains. Buffalo and other critters, too. And the Indians have been here forever. Their bones are down there in the earth. I'm told that over in the old country, you can't dig 6 feet without uncovering skulls and leg bones and such. People have been living there since the beginning, and their bones have kind of filled up the ground. It's interesting to think about all the bones in the ground, but it's just fellow creatures. It's nothing to shy from."
It was such a startling thought that under him, beneath the long grass, were millions of bones, that Newt stopped, feeling so strained. He rode beside Mr. Gus, thinking about it, the rest of the night.
Chapter 73.
As soon as he had the herd well settled, Dish decided to see if there was anything he could do for Lorena. It had been months since the afternoon in Lonesome Dove when he had got so drunk. In all that time, he had not even spoken to her. He was out of practice. In fact, he had never been in practice, though it was not his fault. He would cheerfully have talked to Lorena all day and all night, but she didn't want it, and they had never exchanged more than a few words. His heart was beating hard, and he felt more fearful than if he were about to swim a swift river as he approached her tent. Gus had set up the tent before he left, but it was supper time, so Dish got a plate of beef for Lorena's supper. He took his responsibilities so seriously that he had tried to pick out the best piece, in the process holding up the line and irritating the crew, none of whom were the least impressed with his responsibilities.
"That gal don't need beefsteak. She can just eat you if she's hungry, Dish," Jasper said. "I expect you'd make about 3 good bites for a woman like her." Dish flared up at Jasper's insulting tone, but he had the plate in his hand and was in no position to fight.
"I'll settle you when I come back, Jasper," he said. "You've provoked me once too often."
"Hell, you better run for the border then, Jas," Soupy Jones said. "With a top hand like Dish after you, you won't stand a chance."
Dish had to mount holding the plate, which was awkward, but no one offered to help.
"Why don't you walk?" Pocampo suggested. "The tent is not very far."
That was true, but Dish preferred to ride, which he did, managing not to spill any of Lorena's food. She was sitting just inside the tent with the flaps open.
"I've come with some food," Dish said, still on his horse.
"I'm not hungry," Lorena said. "I'll wait till Gus gets back."
It seemed to Dish that she was as grudging in her tone as ever. He felt foolish sitting on a horse holding a plate of beefsteak, so he dismounted.
"Gus is after them horse thieves," he said. "He might not be back for a day or two. I'm supposed to look after you."
"Send Newt," Lorena said.
"Well, he went too," Dish said.
Lorena came out of the tent for a moment and took the plate. Dish was paralyzed to be so close to her after so many months. She went right back into the tent.
"You don't need to stay," she said. "I'll be all right."
"I'll help you with the tent in the morning," he said. "Captain said we're to ease on north." Lorena didn't answer. She closed the flaps of the tent. Dish walked back toward the campfire, but he stopped about halfway and staked his horse. He didn't want to go back to camp, even to eat, for he would just have to box Jasper Fant if he did. It was full dusk, but to his irritation, Lippy spotted him and came walking over.
"Did you get a good look at her, Dish?" Lippy asked.
"Why, yes," Dish said. "I delivered her supper, if you don't mind."
Is she still as beautiful? Lippy asked, remembering their days together at the dry bean when she had come down toward noon every day. He and Javier would both wait for her and would feel better just watching her walk down the stairs. Why, yes, Dish said, not wanting to discuss it, though at least Lippy had spoken respectfully.
Well, that Gus, he would end up with her, Lippy said. Gus is too sly for the girls.
I'd like to know what you mean by that.
Well, I've seen him trick her once, Lippy said,
remembering the extraordinary wager he had witnessed.
He offered to cut the cards for a poke, and he won. Then he paid her $50 anyway. Then he paid me $10 not to tell Jake. He didn't pay me nothing not to tell you, though, Dish,
Lippy added. It occurred to him suddenly that Gus might consider that they had breached their bargain. $50, Dish said, genuinely astonished. He had never heard of such extravagance in his life.
Did he actually pay it? Well, he gave me the $10, Lippy said. I imagine he'd give Lori the $50, too. Gus ain't cheap. He's just crazy.
Dish remembered the night before he had hired on with the Hat Creek outfit, when Gus had lent him $2 for the same purpose on which he had apparently spent $50. There was no figuring the man out. You oughtn't to blabbed, he told Lippy.
I ain't told nobody else, Lippy said,
realizing himself that he shouldn't have blabbed. Lippy soon went back to the wagon, subdued by his own indiscretion, but not before assuring Dish that the story would go no further. Dish unsaddled his horse and got his bedroll. He lay on the blanket all night, his head on his saddle, thinking of Lori, wondering if his chance with her would ever come. The Kansas sky was thickly seeded with stars. He listened to the Irishman sing the sad songs that seemed to soothe the cattle. He spent the whole night thinking about the woman in the tent nearby, imagining things that might happen when they finally came to Montana and were through with the trail. He didn't sleep, or want to sleep, for there was no telling when he would get a chance to spend another night close to her. His horse grazed nearby on the good grass, which grew wet with dew as the morning came. Dish saddled a little before sunup and rode out to look at the herd, which was perfectly peaceful. Then he went to the wagon, ignoring Jasper and Soupy, who were as insolent as ever. He wanted to teach them both a lesson, but couldn't afford the time. The herd had to be set moving, and somebody would have to hold the point. It was a ticklish problem, for he couldn't hold the point and help Lori, too. He fixed a plate for Lorena and just grabbed a hunk of bacon for himself.
"Why, look at him. He's taking her breakfast," Jasper said. "Dish, you're so good at toting food, you ought to work in a hotel."
Dish ignored this sally and walked over to the tent with a plate of food. He was hoping that she would be in a talking mood. All night, as he had lain awake, he had thought of things he might say to her, things that would make her see how much he loved her or convince her how happy he could make her. If he could just get her talking for 5 minutes, he might have the opportunity to change everything. But when he walked up to the tent, Lorena was already standing outside it, buttoning her shirt. She turned, and he stopped and blushed, fearful that he had ruined everything by approaching at the wrong time. All the speeches he had practiced in the night left him at once.
I brought your breakfast, he said.
Lorena saw that he was embarrassed, although she had only had the top button to go on her shirt. It was just a second of awkwardness, but it brought back memories of her old life that reminded her how it had once pleased her to embarrass men. They might pay her, but they could never really get their money's worth for being embarrassed. She had only to look them in the eye for it to happen. It was her revenge. It didn't work on Gus, but there were precious few like Gus.
"I'll take down the tent while you eat," Dish said.
Lorena sat on her saddle and ate. It took Dish only a few minutes to roll up the tent and carry it to the wagon. Then he came back and saddled her horse for her.
I've got to ride the point, he said. "Just follow along with the wagon. Lippy and the cook will look after you. If you need anything, send for me.
I need Gus, Lorena said. I wish he hadn't left. Do you think he'll come back?
Oh, why, of course he will, Dish said. It was the friendliest she had ever talked to him, though it was about Gus.
I get shaky, she said. Gus knows why. I hope he gets back tonight.
It depends on how big a start the horse thieves had, Dish said. The day passed, and there was no sign of Gus. Lorena rode close to the wagon. Every few minutes, Lippy turned and looked back at her as if he had never seen her before. Almost every time he did, he tipped his hat, which was even filthier than it had been when he worked in the saloon. Lorena didn't acknowledge him. She remembered how he had always tried to look up her skirts when she came down the stairs. She just rode along, watching the horizon, to see if she could spot Gus returning. The horizon shimmered so that it would have been hard to see Gus in any case. They crossed a little creek about noon. There were a few scraggly bushes growing along the line of the creek. Lorena didn't pay them much attention, but Pocampo did. When the herd had moved on, he came walking over to her, his sack half full of wild plums.
These plums are sweet, he said, handing her a few.
She dismounted and ate the plums, which indeed were sweet. Then she walked over and washed her face in the creek. The water was green and cold.
Snow water, Pocampo said.
I don't see no snow, she said.
It comes from up there, Pocampo said, pointing west, from those mountains. You can't see.
Lorena looked, but could only see the brown plain. She ate a few more of the wild plums.
I've been finding onions, Pocampo said. That's good. I'll put them in the beans.
I wish you'd find Gus, she thought. But of course that was impossible. They rode into the dusk, but Gus did not return. Soon after the herd was bedded, Dish came and unrolled the little tent. He could tell from Lorena's face that she was sad. She had unsaddled, and she sat by her saddle in the grass. It pained him to see her look so alone and so tired. He tried to think of something to say that might cheer her up, but words had deserted him again. They always seemed to desert him just when he needed them most.
I guess those horse thieves had a big start on him, he said.
He could be dead, Lorena said.
No, not Gus. He's had lots of experience with horse thieves. Besides, he's got the captain with him. They're expert fighters.
Lorena knew that. She had seen Gus kill the Kiowas and the buffalo hunters. But it didn't ease her fears. She would have to lie in the tent all night, worrying. A bullet could hit anyone, she knew, even Gus. If he didn't come back, she would have no hope of protection.
Well, I'll always help if you'll let me, Dish said. I'll do about anything for you, Lori.
Lorena knew that already, but she didn't want him to do anything for her. She didn't answer, and she didn't eat either. She went into the tent and lay awake all night while Dish Boguette sat nearby, keeping watch. It seemed to him he had never felt so lonely. The mere fact that she was so close and yet they were separate made the loneliness keener. When he had just thrown his blanket down with the boys, he didn't imagine her so much, and he could sleep. Now she was just a few yards away. He could have crept up to the tent and heard her breathing, and yet it seemed he would never be able to eliminate those few yards. In some way, Lori would always be as distant from him as the Kansas stars. At times he felt that he had almost rather not be in love with her, for it brought him no peace. What was the use of it, if it was only going to be so painful? And yet she had spoken to him in a friendly voice only that day. He couldn't give up while there was a chance. He lay awake all night with his head on his saddle, thinking of Lori, not sleeping, nor even wanting to.
Chapter 74.
When they found Will Barger's man, Chick, and the boy who had been traveling with them, there wasn't much left to bury. The coyotes and the buzzards had had a full day at them.
As they rode toward the little knoll where the buzzards swarmed, they passed a fat old badger carrying a human hand, a black hand at that. Newt was stunned.